will be a good overview and introductory economics class, and I need to provide some kind of a setting or framework so we can put Reagan's economics in it, and then I want to do some analysis of just what the consequences might be of some of the things that Reagan is trying to do. So to begin, I'm going to give you a little history of economics. There are really two basic schools of thought in economics. The first is a classical school. And the classical school of economics says that if you produce a certain level of output in a country, that's the supply. If you produce a given supply, they say that supply creates its own demand. In other words, if I produce $2.6 trillion worth of goods, that's what the United States is doing. You ever written $2.6 trillion on a paper to get some idea of how much you produce? If I produce that amount of output, that will generate a sufficient demand to buy what we just produced. So that when people produce it, they receive income for working. They will take that income and then spend it on the goods that were just produced. And in each little market where there's a demand and supply, those markets will all clear and will always be at full employment. We will always buy whatever we produce. And so the classical economist said, let's just sit back and let the economy take care of itself. We don't need to intervene in it. We don't need a government. Just let the economy operate on its own. And so they dealt with issues of like economic growth. How can we make the economy grow faster? Then along comes a fellow by the name of John Maynard Keynes. By the way, the classical economist really began with Adam Smith, about 1776, and went up to about the time of Keynes, although we moved from classical to neoclassical. Then comes John Maynard Keynes, an English economist, and Keynes says, there's something wrong with the classical economics. We have unemployment at times. Here we have a society that has unlimited wants. And we don't even buy all the goods we produce sometimes. And we don't even use all the resources we have. We have unemployment. There's something wrong with classical economics. So Keynes created what we call macroeconomics. Macroeconomics is where we study economics at the national level. And I'm going to give you, it won't be a graph, but I'm going to try and give you some idea of how Keynes analyzed the economy. Oh, I guess it is going to look a little bit like a graph. On this axis, I'm going to put dollars worth of supply. And let's say that the United States is producing $2.6 trillion worth of output. So I'll put $2.6 trillion here. If we're going to be in equilibrium, we should be able to buy all of the goods we produced. And hopefully we will not try to buy more goods, demand more goods than we produced. If we don't buy all the goods we produced, we have unemployment. It will lead to unemployment. If we try to buy more goods than we produce, it's going to lead to inflation. So what we'd like to do is see that the country demands just what it supplies. So if we supply or produce $2.6 trillion of goods and services, let's demand that. So on this axis over here, I'll put the dollars of demand, and then I'll draw a 45-degree line. And what we'd like to do is say if we produce $2.6 trillion in supply, let's hope that the demand for those goods is also $2.6 trillion. If that demand equals the supply, we're in equilibrium. We don't have any problems. Everybody's working. We don't have inflation. Well, Keynes said, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes the demand is greater than the 2.6, and we try to buy $2.8 trillion worth of goods. We have the money, we try to spend it and buy it. Or sometimes we may try to buy $2.4 trillion worth of goods. We don't buy all we produce, and that will lead to some unemployment. So what Keynes did was analyze demand. And he said, what are the different components of demand? Who spends money? Well, he said there are four main sectors. The first sector is the household, and that their spending is called consumption. So when you go out and buy a durable good, non-durable good, a service, that's consumption. The second group that spends money is the business sector, and they invest. We call that investment. If you should buy a house or produce a house, we also call that investment. The third sector is the government. The government sector will buy goods and services. And the fourth sector is the rest of the world. We trade with the rest of the world. So the fourth sector, I'll put the rest of the world here, and that's our exports and imports. What Keynes tried to do was say, if our demand is too great, we're trying to buy 2.68 trillion and we only produce 2.6, we've got to do something to slow down the demand. How can we control the amount of money people, or the amount that people spend? And if there isn't enough demand to buy what we produced, then we've got to try and encourage people to spend money. Well, Keynesian economics then led to a lot of growth on the part of the government. We passed some laws in 1946 that said the government was responsible for promoting full employment without inflation. By the way, those laws are creating enormous problems for us today because of inflation. That's the fourth lecture. Keynesian economics then put the emphasis on government involvement in the economy, and the key to Keynesian economics is we want to control the demand for the country. And we did that through the 60s and through most of the 70s. We tried to control demand. I'll just give you a brief idea of how we tried to do that. For consumption, how do you try and get people to spend more or less? You change taxes. You raise taxes, you don't have as much to spend. You lower taxes, you give people more money to spend. What about investment? You can work with the money supply and interest rates and try and encourage businesses to spend more or to spend less. Government, well, government just seems to spend more each year. But yet that's through Congress. And the rest of the world, that's a complicated topic because we deal with exchange rates between different countries. The problem we have today, basically, the problem we have today is a little more complicated, and when I talk about inflation, I'll go into a much more detail during the fourth session. But the problem we have today, basically, is that demand is greater than the supply. We try to spend more money, we try to buy more goods than we produce. That tends to be the major problem today. So how have we tried to solve that problem in the 70s and now as we're going to the 80s? Basically, it was Keynesian economics. Control demand, change taxes, change government spending. I'll show you how some of the typical theories that do not hold when you have high inflation. They seem to work good in the 60s. They don't work very good anymore. But Keynesian economics says, attack the demand side. By the way, if you've never had an economics class, economics is nothing but demand and supply. And economists try to figure out how many different ways they can talk about demand and supply and how many different graphs they can draw. But every time it comes down to demand and supply. And what affects the demand? What affects the supply? That's the key to economics. Well, what we have done for many years because of Keynesian economics is put an emphasis on demand. And so Keynesian economics really means controlling the demand or the spending in the country. And we look at those four different components. We'd like to control the demand so that it hits right at the point where we're producing. And then we have full employment and we don't have inflation. Now, I think this is the time to bring Reagan's economics into the picture. Reagan is still concerned about demand. They're still talking about that. I mean, you're aware of government cuts. They're trying to get the demand down, and they're looking at the government to try and do that. It's tragic that government spending really isn't decreasing, it's just that it's not increasing as fast. And what they're doing is taking the money from those who aren't able to lobby very well, and those who can least afford it, to use to build up really our military. It's kind of tragic. But they tried to get other people to stop spending, and we just all went out and borrowed money and just ignored what they were doing for the most part. And so now that seems to be the best way that they can find to cut down on demand. But Reagan's economics, although it has something to do with demand, the new thing that Reagan has really done is reintroduce the whole supply side of this problem. Keynesian economics said we're basically short run. It emphasized demand. Because it was short run, we say it was fairly static. And what we tried to do was produce at full capacity. That means full employment, using all of our resources. That's what Keynesian economics was trying to do. Now Reagan has come along, and because of the classical economists and what they've said, a lot of what Friedman has said, they are reintroducing what we call supply-side economics. They're looking at it a little. It isn't anything new. It's really going back and looking at some of the same things that we were talking about before Keynesian economics more or less took over. Now, in supply-side economics, what happens is we deal with the long run. We aren't dealing with changing demand over the few months or whatever. We're looking at a long-run solution. It is the supply side that we're very concerned about. Remember, Reagan hasn't given up on the demand side. They're still working there. But they're saying we've got to look at the other part of the problem, supply. And what we're going to do is try to expand our capacity to produce. Now here, we're just going to try and take a target, full employment, and hit it. That's all. Now we're going to try and move that target out over time. So if I were to draw this little simple graph again with the 45 degree line, in Keynesian economics, you say, where's full employment? And you try to hit the target. In supply side economics, what you're emphasizing is trying to move that target out over the years. You try to produce more. And one of the reasons why we've gone back to supply side economics is in 3 of the last 5 years in the United States, we have had negative growth. Nobody knows that, really, because few know that, because we've had so much inflation that we see our GNP, our total production, going up from 2.2 trillion to 2.6 trillion. It's just going up because of inflation. 3 out of 5 years, we didn't get growth. And what I think Reagan is trying to say, and his advisors, is we spend so much time looking at that target and trying to hit it and worrying about demand, we have forgotten about the supply side. So for me, Reagan economics what he's really added is supply side economics. And my view of supply side economics, and the reason why I want to deal with that today, is that to me, supply side economics is equal to the whole concept of economic growth. Let's see, I'll try and summarize this one other way. I'll put a demand curve here, or a demand and supply. We said that's the problem. We're trying to buy too much. We're trying to buy more than we produce. There are two solutions. You try to get the demand to fall, so we don't spend so much, and we're still working on that. And you try, the other one is, why not just get the supply to go up? And if you can get the supply to increase, and it takes a while, and I'll go through that in a few minutes, if you can get the supply to increase, two good things will probably happen. One is, inflation is going to decrease somewhat, because there's the inflation problem. Demand's greater than supply. The supply comes up and there's more to buy. We won't have that extra pressure put on prices. As everybody tries to buy the goods and pushes the prices up, if we can produce more goods, there won't be that extra demand, that excess demand. Prices won't go up as fast. And the other thing that it may do is create some jobs as we produce more. That's a complicated issue. It has to do with the elasticities and technology, but hopefully it'll create some more jobs. So what I've said so far is that we're not moving away from Keynesian economics. It's just that we're trying to look at the whole picture, and what we're doing is reintroducing the importance of the supply side. You cannot ignore the supply side, and I guess that's what I want to do. Next is look at what really is the supply side economics of Reagan. What is Reagan trying to do? What I'm going to do now is really kind of interesting, that it's an economic growth lecture, because as I said, supply side economics is really economic growth. I'm a development economist, and I used to always teach economic growth in those courses, because the poor countries need some growth to overcome, or to provide basic needs. But I did not teach economic growth very often in a U.S. economics course because over the last 15, 20 years, we kind of assumed that supply would take care of itself. In classical economics, you say, worry about supply, the demand will be there. That takes a while to explain, and we don't have the time. In Keynesian economics, we say, worry about the demand, and if it grows fine, then the supply will automatically take care of itself. They're almost reversed, and now we're really putting the two together. We're trying to worry about both demand and supply. Well, what is it that we need to do in supply-side economics to get increases in output? I probably don't need to use the board. I should apologize for that. It's just that that's the only way I've ever taught. And I don't know if I could sit in that chair for 45 minutes and talk. So maybe it's a release of nervous energy. Economic growth is a function of, it depends on the following things. It depends on, one, natural resources. Natural resources, anything God made, minerals, trees, water, climate, etc. It depends on human resources. People who work with their hands, people who work with their minds, the entrepreneurs who organize production. It depends on technology. Technology is a very difficult term to define. I worked in a program, Technology and Social Change, for 2 years. We never did define it. But basically what it's saying is, because of a new breakthrough invention, innovation, you can produce more goods with the same input. Same input, you can produce more goods. Or you could produce the same amount of goods with fewer inputs. The next variable is capital. Capital to an economist is machinery, tools, building, communications, roads, things like this. It is not dollar bills. It is not money. You need capital. And then I'll say something about the social, political setting. I guess I'll leave it at those five variables. What is Reagan doing in each of these areas? As far as natural resources are concerned, I would think that the people out west here, and those who've been in Alaska, are aware that we're opening up a lot of new territory to go after natural resources. And so we've cut back on some of the environmental laws, and there's much more exploration going on now. I think that's really a major change in Reagan policy. And the fellow, is it Watt, who's the Secretary of the Interior, said that, I don't know if you noticed how he's been using biblical quotes to support much of what he's been doing. But they're going to open up a lot of the territory in the United States to try and get more resources, especially resources in the area of energy. As far as human resources go, well, I might add here with natural resources, certainly you can trade. And I visited with someone here who was making steel, and I had chances to talk to the people in the steel industry. There are a couple of resources that they desperately need to make steel, and only South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Russia, Soviet Union, have those resources. And so if you want growth, you know automatically we're going to look for the resources where they are and try and ensure that supply. Human resources. This is the one that I have a problem with in Reagan. If you want growth and you need more raw materials and resources, that's pretty obvious. You need human resources. Usually we talk about education. We don't really need more people. We need the quality to improve. Education's important. Reagan seems to be a little contradictory in the area of education. It's hard. The people from the Department of Education say there won't be that many changes, but there's a lot of talk. In the area of health, we saw the film last night. Certainly, well, the United States and South Africa are the only two countries with high per capita incomes that don't ensure, in some way, good health for all their people. All the other countries have some kind of a program. But we're not doing much in the area of health. But I think in attitudes, Reagan is certainly trying to create some kind of a positive attitude about growth in the future. And certainly if that's a kind of a cultural power or a tool, or power over the mind, Reagan is working in that area. As far as technology goes, our problems are pretty serious. I'm going to talk about energy during the next session. Reagan would like to see the technology side being taken care of by the private sector, research and development in the private sector. Because I feel that some of our problems right now are immense, and that the private sector is not going to be able to do it alone. Granted, we need to unleash the private sector if we want growth. The problems are so great. That worries me a little bit, but a lot of emphasis is put on research and development in the private sector. I should go back to human resources too. The entrepreneur. I think the Reagan administration will do what it can to try and help small business and the individuals and the entrepreneur free them of a lot of controls so that they can start producing more. Then capital accumulation. Capital. That, when you talk about economic development, economic growth for poor countries, that is the issue that you probably hit hardest from an economic point of view. By the way, this is the economics of economic growth. There are a lot of other factors that affect economic growth, but I'm just dealing with the economics. Capital is essential for growth. If you want to produce more goods, you have to produce more machinery, more equipment, better communications. You just have to do that. There is no way you can take that same spade with the same people and get more production per person or more output for the country. You have to move up to a more sophisticated machine or some kind of a tool that makes the individual more productive. How do you get more capital? You get it by postponing consumption, saving money. And the United States right now, saving level is very low. Japan is saving something like 25 to 30%. Germany, I think, around 20%. The Soviet Union is having problems, but up around 20, 25%, they've been higher. The United States is fluctuating around 10, 11, 12%. You need to save money and invest it in machinery and capital if you want to become more productive. And that is where I think Reagan is probably hitting hardest. Now, he talks about an across-the-board tax cut. What they would like to do is see the people who get some of that money back take some of it and put it into savings. And when they put it into savings, businesses will borrow it and invest in new machinery, plant, equipment. That's what they're hoping for. If you really want to produce capital to get growth, then you may have to change the tax structure so that it's not simply an across-the-board tax cut, but you need to emphasize any kind of tax breaks, whatever, that will encourage businesses to invest in capital. And so it will favor businesses over the consumer. I know that with tax write-offs, the people in Canada can put up a lot of plants like steel, et cetera, and write off all of their investments in 4 or 5 years. And a lot of our companies still need 12, 15 years to do that. And from changing those kind of rules to encourage capital, accumulation, building up of our capital, a lot. The last one is social, political, cultural, economic, whatever, the setting in which we operate. What Reagan is doing here is saying government has become too involved. The government has got to get off the backs of business. Our regulations are too tough on the environment. Our regulations are too tough as far as the creative element of trying to produce more. People that I talk to, especially in farming, say that it's just unbelievable what you can and can't do anymore because of government regulations. So they're trying to pull back there. But most of what Reagan is trying to do is supply-side economics, is get economic growth, make it possible so we can produce more. That will take pressure off of inflation and hopefully create some jobs. Economic growth takes a long time. You can increase demand overnight. You just decide to spend more or borrow more, basically. But to increase the supply takes time because you have to go out and produce the machinery. Yes?
I just wanted to throw one thing in here. On this economic growth, this classical view, would you say that in both the social political setting and human resources setting, the idea of freeing up those who have, as opposed to those who have not, for continual growth is like freedom, is the way to achieve this economic growth. Therefore, let those who have the resources to begin with increase them, propagate that, and the have-nots are, essentially, since they don't have anything to start with, they're not going to be given the edge for growth on their own level. I think that's the thing that, you know, seems to be struggling with the Keynesian view. There's a need to bring up the lower class. In this setting, it seems like there's going to be a lower class flag for the possibility of that. Does that fit into the system? Or
oh, definitely. Keynesian economics, which brings the government into the picture, not only tries to promote full employment and pull down inflation, and it's also interested in economic growth, but is very concerned about the distribution of income. And so that's just one of the economic roles, is to try and find some equitable distribution of income. And so the Keynesian economics has never tried to bring about growth, say, at the expense of the people at the bottom. And I think you're right. This Reagan economics is saying that the Keynesian model of trying to promote growth and still help those at the bottom isn't working very good. And we need to retreat and go with those who already know how to produce and already have the know-how, put the money there, and get the size of the pie to grow so that we will all get a larger share. Now, I was going, when I finished this section, I was going to ask two questions. Is economic growth possible? Because, so you have to, they're assuming it's possible. And they're going to try and get the pie to grow, and they're going to put the money back in the hands of people who already make those decisions, are already producing, and assume, and take some of the money from those at the bottom. And so one question is growth possible? The second one is growth desirable? And I want to deal with those questions. And in the process of dealing with the question, is growth desirable? I'm going to deal with that in more detail. And if it's okay with you, I might wait until that time. And if it's not, if you still have further questions, then we'll get to. I guess I've pretty much finished this. Economic growth, supply-side economics. How do you get the supply to increase? You need more resources. You need to improve the quality of your labor force, although I'm not sure Reagan is doing that. In fact, I hear statements that in science and technology and math, the United States is way behind Europe and the Soviet Union, and it doesn't seem that we're placing much emphasis on education in those areas, so there seems to be an inconsistency there. But on technology, certainly they're going to try and promote research and development, but through the private sector, in part will be removing a lot of the controls and regulations, and capital. That's really the key. We need savings so we can produce more capital and get future growth. Well, there are a couple questions. One is, will it work? I kind of have to apologize for what I'm going to say right now, because in order to understand whether or not it will work, you need a lot of additional information. And that information is going to come in session 4 when we talk about inflation. But unless you understand the predicament we're in today with inflation and unemployment, it really doesn't make any sense for me to try to tell you whether it's going to work or not today, because it's more complex than what I have on the board. And so what I want to do today is, I said, a global perspective on what Reagan is doing. I want to take that path and do the inflation part on the fourth session. So the question becomes then, is this solution a good idea or a bad idea? Well, first then, is it possible? We could get into a fairly lengthy debate on whether it's possible. In the early 70s, there was a book that came out that said there are limits to growth. Well, I guess I am around too many people that work in the area of technology. And I realize that Thomas Malthus thought we didn't have much hope at all in trying to rise above the subsistence level of living. In fact, Thomas Malthus gave the name of economics of a dismal science, because there was really no hope. He didn't think they could get economic growth to grow fast enough, output to grow fast enough to raise the level of living. Well, Malthus was so wrong that over the 160 years or 180 years, that I must admit I'm a little skeptical about saying that it is not possible. And when I hear some of the new technologies using laser beams or microwaves shoot energy down from solar collectors out in space and collecting them out in, should I pick on North Dakota again? collecting them out in North Dakota, Kansas, somewhere, Wyoming, where we have a lot of space, and then channeling it to different places around the United States. I mean, there are a lot of technologies that are being worked on right now. And so whether or not it's possible or not, from a U.S. point of view, I'll take that up later if somebody wants to, but I don't think that that's a tough issue to work with, and I'm not that worried about that at this time. Whether it's possible for the entire world to reach a level of development like the United States, I don't see how that's possible. We have, in the United States, 220 million people and a per capita income of about 9,000 per person. Well, you just take China and India with 1.6, 1.7 billion people in those two countries and incomes of around $200-$300, maybe $400. I think India might even be a little lower. And you try to raise all of that 1.6 billion people to a per capita income of $10,000, then you can really talk about, is it possible? It's totally impossible as far as I can see. I just don't know how you could do it. So what I want to deal with today is the whole question of, is growth desirable? I'm going to put some analysis on the board so you can make some of your own decisions. I'm pretty biased in this area and have made up my decision a long time ago. But I'd like to put up some of the pros and cons of economic growth, and then see if we think that what Reagan's solution, because there's a solution, economic growth, an emphasis on economic growth will take care of our problems. How wise a solution is that in the first place, given some of the things that I'd like to talk about in the next few minutes? There's another thing I'd like to do today too, and that is, because yesterday we talked about economic systems, whether or not capitalism, socialism, or some other system might be better, I want to bring into the argument economic growth and how that affects the systems. I told you this would be a crash course in economics, so I'm going to tell you what economics is now. I'm finally going to define it. Most textbooks would say economics works like this. We have unlimited wants. And we have limited resources. What economists have to do, and what their major role is to find the most efficient way to use those scarce resources to produce as many goods and services as possible. So economists are efficiency experts. And I might add, I didn't say this yesterday, but capitalism is without a doubt the most efficient system. Nobody denies that. That doesn't make any difference what system you come from. Based on a couple of these assumptions. Oh, it's so efficient, you just can't believe it. And the Soviet Union has tried to match the efficiency, and even the Soviet economists all say they're 25 to 30% more inefficient than the United States. And they admit it, they realize that. Well, this is our definition. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing, in addition to asking whether or not economic growth is good or bad, is asking whether or not this is what economics should be all about. I have some problems with this definition. We assume that we have unlimited wants. We do a good job at increasing, trying to stimulate wants. As Fox says, most of the creativity in the United States shows up in advertising. And we're always trying to find ways to encourage or to persuade people that they don't have enough. So we do a good job of that. And that really bothers me, probably because I've traveled quite a bit and been in some other countries, and I know what we have and I know what they don't have. The limited resources bothers me in that the world is finite. I don't think many people would argue with that. But the economists will argue with the fact that resources are not fixed. We have a finite world, but what's technology all about? What are the land-grant institutions all about? It's finding ways to produce more, finding new resources, new technologies to get those resources. So our resources may be fixed today, but who knows what we're going to find tomorrow that becomes usable and economically feasible. What bothers me is we think so much that they're not fixed that we just don't say much about the fact that they're finite. I don't think economists, well, even though lately we've been talking about scarcity, I really don't think economists respect the whole concept of scarcity. Yeah, that really bothers me. Well, economics then, what's the end product going to be? Unlimited wants and scarce resources. We're going to constantly try and strive for more output, more economic growth. Progress, growth is capitalism. It's what we know. My mother wants me to have more than she had, and I'm supposed to want my children to have more than I have. And that's the way capitalism tends to go. Where has it taken us? I'll just make a couple comments about this definition. When I'm in South America, in Peru specifically, a lot of my friends down there say, you know what we think of the people in the United States? This is the image that we get. People in the United States are worried about three things: how much money they're going to earn, how they're going to spend that money, and three, how they're going to keep it so nobody else can take it from them. And they said by the time that people in the United States are finished worrying about those three things, they don't have much time to do anything else. Now, I'm not sure that's a real accurate picture of people in the United States, and certainly there are a lot of exceptions, but I don't think it's too terribly far off. And that really hurts me, to be in a country like Peru and have people look at my country and associate those kinds of things with my country. They don't talk about human rights, compassion, concern for the environment, for other people. It's always in terms of money. And the second thing that I'd like to say about this, and I need to get some help from you, Larry, because I heard this twice. Once when I was driving through North Dakota. I don't know why North Dakota keeps coming up here, but as I was driving through North Dakota,
strong sense of humor.
I heard about a Roper poll, and I know that you've included in some of your writing. And what I heard, I thought, had different times or different years than what I saw in your writing. So you tell me if I'm way off. Please correct me. But a Roper poll was taken. I assume it was a cross-section. This is what I remember from hearing the report, that it was a cross-section of people in the United States. I mean, they weren't trying to pick on any one group. And they asked, what are the three things that bring you the most, or make you most happy, bring you the most satisfaction? I thought the first year was 1960, but I've seen that you, in your writing, that poll was from later, like the mid-70s. But anyway, I think the point, I hope, will still be valid. The three things are this. One, the top was, I want a good job that brings me some satisfaction. I want to make a contribution to my society. The second one was a good marriage, and the third one was the family. That's what brings me satisfaction. In 1979, the same poll was taken in the same area, same random samples, and the three were: number one, money brings me the most satisfaction; number two was my car; and number three was television. Now, you know, I don't want to generalize too much on that, but if that says anything about what we think economics is all about, unlimited wants and trying to create more and more and more and trying to achieve those, and that's where it's taking us, at least for me, I think we need to stop and look at not only supply-side economics, but just economic growth in general. When there are surveys taken about what really makes you happier, if you get more money, are you happier? Most of the results are, I'm only happier if in relative terms, I'm getting more than someone else. In other words, if I'm moving up and others aren't, that brings satisfaction. But if everybody is moving up with me, it's really not bringing that much satisfaction. So it's a relative thing. Well, you know, those are just a couple of sides. But if that's the case, I think we need to look at economic growth, and I think we need to look at Reagan economics. So how do you analyze
Oh, I want to, let me just throw out a new definition for economics. It's one that I'm interested in. By the way, what I have to say today is probably of interest to about 5% of the United States on a good day. it certainly isn't mainstream. But I think economics ought to look like this. We ought to have limited wants. Decide what it is that we really think is necessary. My wife and I made lists. And so each year we decide what it is we think we need to get or what we don't need to get, and then we try to stop at that. And now that I got to Disney World and the motorcycle, I'm just about done. The motorcycle was for energy. Disney World, I can't explain that. If you have limited wants, what we ought to do is try and find out how we can, in the most efficient way possible, meet those limited wants. And in my case, we need to heat your house. I'm working on some kind of a passive solar thing this summer to try and see how I can use the fewest amount of resources to meet that. I think that's where economics ought to head. And when you hear a fellow like Schumacher talking, that's, I think, what he's trying to say. How can you use the fewest resources to meet a set amount of wants? Well, that's not really where the United States is at today. But I think it's something that we need to pay more attention to. Let me quickly run through.
Mark?
Yes.
How is the new economics going to reflect that? That is, if you have a house that no longer needs $600 worth of oil, and you no longer buy $600 worth of oil, and none of us do, the gross national product is going to look like it's smaller. And it's going to look like we have no growth, when actually we're just as warm as we were before. How are you economists going to take that into consideration? And in fact, could that be what's happened over the last 3 out of the 5 years? Because it's going to look like we're making less money, and we actually are, but we're satisfying the same needs.
I'm going to talk about some different economic systems and alternatives on, I guess it's the fifth session. What is responsible action? How do we act responsibly in a world like today? And there is no doubt that economists are going to have enormous problems. It's a matter of attitude, how people see things, how you define growth, what is the quality of life. And my interest is working at the grassroots. That just tends to be the way I operate. And it's going to just have to be individuals who start to do that. Now, I think our economy can handle small changes. Our economy cannot handle big shocks. My goodness, if we all built solar collectors tomorrow to heat our homes and we could use some passive solar, the effect it would have on our country would be just devastating. I mean, loss of jobs, whatever. And so if we go to a new system and we do it in a short period of time, it's going to create problems. So you just can't deny that either. And it's either going to have to be done, well, I'm getting really into a lot of the issues that we'll deal with on the fifth session, but it's going to have to be done either like at a national level by an authoritative, benevolent dictator, or it may work at the grassroots where slowly we make those changes. When we moved from feudalism to capitalism, it took something like 500-800 years. Nobody knows how long it took. Exactly. It's hard to pinpoint. And I think you're already seeing small changes where people are making those adjustments. And if it does come slowly, I don't think it will create some of the problems. Now, if the country is really hung up on GNP, measured in dollars, and just can't accept that, then we've got a real problem with attitudes. Yeah.
Well, my question is also about not how the nation will handle it, but how will you economists handle it? Because you're not going to be your numbers and your tools aren't going to reflect any of this. It's going to look like we're in a recession. The cost of living thing is built in everybody's scales. How are we going to know when we do this?
I'm not so terribly worried about unemployment, and I don't think I would define a recession without looking carefully at what's happening to employment. I mean, if GNP is falling and people are still fully employed and you don't hear a lot of people complaining, I guess I don't think that'd create a problem. But if you're asking how will the economists handle this, I must just be very honest, I don't have the slightest idea. Because I am certainly in the minority of economists to even be talking about these things. And a lot of the colleagues just assume, I mean, the people that I teach with, just assume that economic growth is possible, and that's what we're going to continue to do. I wish that there was an easy answer. What I usually say, the bottom line is, somehow we've got to teach a sense of compassion. We've got to instill that in this country again, so that we worry about other people, the environment, and all of those things, and then everything else will follow. And until you make that change in compassion and attitudes, I mean, it isn't going to be easy. I don't even know if we can do it. And I wish it would be easier.
If I hear the question, it's that the economists have certain tools by which to measure the economic well-being of the country. Those tools are used when we make national policy, so that the government decides to do this or that on the basis, in part, of the economists' measuring of things. Now, we may be doing some things which further the economic well-being of the country, for example, the example was a good one given, not using as much fossil fuels and still keeping relatively warm. That, however, shows up in a way for which the economic tools aren't prepared to measure. If either the economic measurement has to be different, or else you have to don't use those policies based on that, because you'd be frustrating what is going on.
It would seem to me that it would possibly be reflected in the growth side, where we would not be spending as much for fossil fuels, either import or mining, but that it would be reflected in the purchases he has to make to develop that technology.
And it could. It would depend on the kind of, if people are willing to accept lower incomes, then I think, you know, your argument's true. Then it's not going to show up. If all that does is free income to do something else, then we won't see any change in the GNP. But that is a real good point. I haven't thought about that one before. If we're making our decisions based on GNP, we've got problems. If we're making our decisions based on unemployment and inflation rates, then I don't think we've got some of the same problems. But if I say we've got to increase the supply-side economics, and we've got to have supply-side economics because our GNP is not growing, that's serious. Because as you say, it may be growing in different ways, and it's not measurable. If I say we've got to do supply-side economics because inflation's too high and we don't have jobs, then I think then I can see why they would use that. That's really a good point. Thanks. We do have something called the Physical Quality of Life Index. That there are a lot of people working on different indicators of what GNP really is.
Yeah.
It's just that the economists aren't the ones that are taking them on and adapting them or adopting them. But that's an excellent point. Time might be a factor here. I would really like to allow some time for discussion and questions. Yet I have about 22. So I will go through this quickly and then open it up. And if you're willing to listen for a few more minutes, I might make a few comments on the whole idea of benefit-cost analysis as you look at economic growth. By the way, economists, that's one of their major tools, benefit-cost analysis. You don't do anything without experiencing some cost, opportunity cost. So when something good comes, it comes at the expense of something else. So I want to look at economic growth, the benefits and the costs. One of the reasons for economic growth is to increase the level of living. That's based on our economic definition. Unlimited wants, scarce resources. Let's produce more. Let's have a higher standard of living. Very important to the United States. And if population is growing, you will want to have some growth. A second argument is that it will solve the domestic problems. I think I'm getting back to your question now. What you're saying is if you have economic growth, however you get it, and it may mean you have to rely on those who already understand it and can promote it fastest. What's happening is the size of the GNP, the output you produce, is growing. So that the poor in the United States are receiving something like 6%. The poorest 20% of the families.
get 6%, well, even if they get the same 6%, the size of the pie has grown, and that's how we solve the problems. That's one of the reasons why the question of is whether or not growth is possible is very important. Because if we go that route, and it isn't possible because of scarce resources, what it's doing to the environment, and all of that, then to go this route is a disaster because you've redistributed from the poor to the rich, and you haven't gotten the size of the pie to go anywhere. It's still there. And believe me, that's a real concern on the part of the people who are trying to speak for the poor and the oppressed today. A third argument for this is image. I used to really get a big kick out of this one because during the Cold War, we had to show the rest of the world that the United States could grow much faster and meet needs. And it was a contest between the Soviet Union. Well, that sort of passed away, and yet people were still using that argument. But for as useless an argument as I thought it was, do you know how real it has become today? And I think this may get back to the question you just raised about, is our GNP really going up or not? But we, the United States, are embarrassed today because we're a second-rate producer. Germany has gone by us. Even Great Britain, despite all their problems, has solved a couple of them. Japan just went away, just moving right by us. Sweden, Canada, we are embarrassed that we're second-rate. And if there's no, and that's why Reagan says we've got to get some pride back in this country. We have to be proud to be U.S. citizens. We've got to produce more. And I used to think that there was nothing to this one, but I think it had a lot of impact on the last election. Reinstill that pride as great producers at the top. Now, what are some of the costs? First of all, we have dwindling resources. I'll just put in here scarcity. We could debate that back and forth, and I doubt we'd come to any kind of solution, but that's part of the question of whether or not growth is possible. But clearly, we're going to lose some resources in the process, and some that have some very important uses, for example, petroleum, and we're not using them, I think, always in the best way possible. A second question will be, cost will be the environment. What's going to happen to the environment? I really think, I teach an environmental economics class, I really think we've gone too far in certain areas in protecting the environment. Not very many, but in some. And there are some cases to be made for that. But in other areas, I think we have a long ways to go. And I was visiting with a fellow who came here from Norway, and he says in his home country, acid rain coming up from the continent and England had just all but destroyed the fishing in some of the lakes. And so there are problems that we have not yet solved as far as the environment goes. And in the process of producing, you create pollution. You can't get rid of matter. You've got waste. And there may be some limits there. These are physical limits to growth. As I mentioned, they're debatable. It might be possible to have growth and still worry about the environment if we can come up with some new techniques to handle that, change the form of the pollution so it's not as dangerous. A third one has to do with human relationships. I think this is what I had in mind when I used that Roper poll. What has happened to human relationships in the United States? There are some real social costs. A fellow by the name of Hirsch has written a book called The Social Limits to Grow. Not the physical limits to grow, as the Club of Rome did, but the social limits to grow. What's happened to community? Jacques Ellul would say, in the technological society, we have become slaves to the machine, rather than the machine a tool to help us out. And I'm a slave right now to my motorcycle. That thing just isn't working. And I've spent a lot of hours on that thing, trying to save money, and a lot of dollars.
Slave your chalk.
Yes, I am. Part of this is from Fromm's book, To Have or to Be. What are we really known for? What we have? Conspicuous consumption? Who did we see down at the state park? The fellow who drove his, incredible motorboat. All he did was drive back and forth through the park. He never used it. He just drove it so everybody could see it. Well, are we known by what we have or by who we really are? What is this whole growth doing to us? What about family? Other values. In the Volvo plant in Sweden,
they decided that production was too impersonal, that they needed some changes. It was not humane. They were concerned about goods and not people. So they went to work teams to produce baubles. I don't know if there were 6 to 8 people on the team. And a sociologist friend of mine told me a year or so ago that the end result was that people couldn't stand being on work teams. They had to work, they had to get along with other people, and they all wanted to go back to putting their own little bolt into the car, and that was it. Now, if that's true, I mean, I'm just looking in the last 15, 20 years, where are we going? And that says something about Reagan economics and trying to emphasize supply. Will it work or not? It may work in the short run. I'm concerned about the long run consequences here. A fourth consideration is foreign policy. I looked for the article last night, and I couldn't find it, but it was in Sojourners a couple years ago. Someone gave one of the best reasons for a simpler lifestyle I've ever seen. It's just a 2-page article. It said that if we want to have economic growth, what will our foreign policy look like? Usually there are 3 reasons for foreign policy. One is to security. We want to keep our country secure. And it's stated in the rhetoric. The second reason is we want to maintain our profits overseas. So we want to protect those profits in the supply of inputs. So we keep our economy going and we get growth and profits. And the third is the promotion of human rights. In economic growth, I don't think there's any doubt that we will emphasize securing different areas. Why? We don't even talk about South Africa now because there's so many resources there we need. We can't afford to lose those resources. And the way we're moving in the Middle East, I mean, it dictates our foreign policy. It makes it one of concern of security and economic well-being, I think at the expense of human rights. That scares me. And then the fifth one, and this is probably where I'm getting more into a global citizen, the gap between the rich and the poor. This is the hardest one for me to understand. Here maybe we should be better stewards and not waste as much, and here we've got human relationships, and I suppose to some extent the term shalom fits in there. But this last one is the one that I have the most problems with, and it seems more convincing to me than any others, and that is if you live in another country and you see their lack of resources and their lack of goods and services and basic needs not being met. I cannot understand why I need a second television. I can't say I'm not sure about the first one. I haven't gotten that far yet. But, or a second car, or a lot of clothes. It doesn't make any sense to me when I know that I am using resources that could be used elsewhere in the world, or at least in the future those resources will still be there for those people to use, just to meet basic needs. What we're doing is expanding the gap. We're taking more and more and more, and I can't understand why it is that we really think we need so much more. I'd just make a couple more comments. One is, economic growth can be defined in many different ways, and in a way you were getting at that. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to use the scarce resources or the non-renewable resources. We can have growth in services. I'll just pay to have you come over and play your guitar some night, and you can turn around and pay me, and I'll come over and hit the softball for you for a while. I don't know. We can do those kinds of things. There's a lot of things that can happen that can be measured in goods or services. But we have to watch these dwindling resources. Capitalism depends on growth. It really does. Competition. This idea of accumulating goods, compulsion, greed, coveting what others have, we just instill that in people. And if we are talking about moving away from economic growth, one of the questions is, can capitalism handle it? And can economists handle it? That's part of, I guess, session number 5. Well, I think I went way over. I'm sorry. It's just that when you want to give a crash course in economics, and you usually take the whole semester, 4 months, it's kind of hard to do it in 45 minutes. But the economics is, it's demand and supply. It's controlling unemployment and inflation. It's a question of economic growth. Those are basic questions in economics. Well, right now what I'll do is, for those of you who need to go somewhere, who have been sitting long enough, and you've been sitting quite a while, please feel free to go. And if someone would like to stay and pick up on some discussion, fine, I'll stay around. And I think Larry
you're going to, we'll pick up on this evening too,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, tonight's wide open discussion on all
of it. So, I read the wrong hand. I guess it is about 1 hour now. I wasn't as far off as I thought. Sure, I'm more than happy to stay. But I don't, anybody who needs to stretch or go do some other things, please do so. And the discussion can be points of view. As I said the other day, I'm more interested in knowing what you're thinking than to just answer questions that may be technical terms. If there's something that's not clear, I'd be happy to try and give you some explanation. But if you just have a different point of view or something you'd like to share, please do so. Yes.
The expansion of military spending in the Reagan administration projection, how that related to the economic growth model. Another revival of the Cold War, attitudes and mentality, all of that, very young talk and defense. But is there also an underlying thing about related to demand spending or
Well, before I say anything, I have to admit and be very frank and honest that the whole concept of military spending and what it does to the economy is something that I've never studied in any detail. And in the process of teaching economics courses or theory courses, you don't find much of that at all in economics textbook. There have been times where I've looked through them just to get a little background on it. And so when I get questions like this, and a lot of times that's one of the first questions that comes up, I just have to be very honest and say that I can't really speak very intelligently to that question. There are issues like this. If we didn't put our money into the military, clearly it could be placed elsewhere. So if the Vatican is talking or the Pope, they will say, really the military is coming at the expense of meeting some basic needs for people all around the world. And certainly that's true, but if we didn't spend the money there, I don't really know where it would be spent. It would free up some money to spend it elsewhere. The whole idea of jobs, they say that the amount of money invested in the military create one job is much higher than elsewhere. So some would say if you move money from the military and put it in the private sector elsewhere, it would probably create a few more jobs. But as far as the economy goes, it's when big companies have power and influence and they need contracts to maintain some stability, then there's any doubt that there's the military industrial complex. It's a fairly dangerous thing, and there are a lot of agreements made between two sides to ensure a steady demand for their products so that they don't have to lay people off and relocate. But Larry, do you want to say something to that? Because you just, I saw your hand go up and...
I think it's part of maybe this evening's discussion as well. I'm very interested in that question. I'm just surprised the economists haven't given that more attention, because you're talking about 26-28% of government spending, and to have economists not asking what effect that has on the national economy just amazes me.
Oh, I agree. And in the introductory textbooks, they had something in there on military back in the middle, during the late 60s and early 70s, and now they pulled those out of textbooks. I mean, it's not only have they not moved in that direction, they're moving away from it. So when you see people who have written on it, I think that Barnett has written on it somewhere in Global Reach. And I know that Jack Nelson in his book has a couple chapters on the military and whatever. And that's
one of those who are economists are.
Oh yeah, right. It's not being done by economists. So when you go to look for that material, you're not really going to people in the profession. I'm sure there are some in the profession. I just don't know who they are yet and haven't found out. But there are very few, and it doesn't show up.
The question I would ask is whether Reagan's own economics is not undermined by a sharp increase in the defense budget. Whether you don't have a contradiction there, because defense spending has generally been inflationary. I think probably has always been inflationary.
Well, it's kind of
and
hard.
Secondly, do you drain off your talent from the private sector, research and development, and other things into the military by shifting a lot of the contracting over to the military? Lester Thoreau says Reagan will wreck his own economy by pushing high defense budgets.
The last point I think is really valid, because The research and development done by the military supposedly has all kinds of spin-offs and effects in the private sector. But most of what I've read and studied is not true at all. And so you are pulling a lot of the good people, putting them in there. And even what they do come up with isn't used in the private sector, plus you've lost the work they could have done in the private sector.
Yeah, then we'll sit around and gripe about how West Germany and Japan got ahead of us.
Well, I'll tell you more. If you want to, this is one way where Reagan economics, with the emphasis on the military, could undermine economic growth. It's essential to get savings. But what they're doing is taxing is fairly heavy, even though they cut taxes, and they're taking so much of that savings and putting it into the military that it's free. I mean, if you find out what's left for the private sector or public sector minus military, yeah, all that money tied up in the military is not going into investment in machines and stuff that will help the private sector out very much at all. And so what's the ability of us to save after we get taxed very heavily? Yeah, and it's not as heavy as the Scandinavian countries, but any country that has a large military tends to have problems with inflation, yeah, and tends to have problems with trying to find savings to generate investment, which will in turn generate growth. And so Japan and Germany don't have to worry about military expenditures like we do. Maybe Germany more, but Japan doesn't. And it's no secret, they don't want to get into that business because they know the minute they do, it's going to take funds away from investing in the private sector and it's going to hurt their private sector. So they're going to let us do it. And the more he goes in the military, the more difficult it will be for our private sector to save and invest. I think that's definitely, that would undermine it to some extent.
What happened to the Japanese government when the prime minister went home after making a public statement that they would do more?
I haven't heard. What was the response?
Gone. There was so much reaction in Japan from both the government and the business sector that he's no longer in prime minister.
The Decor paper didn't cover that.
Economic soundness, it just isn't possible in military spending. It's because there's no demand. I mean, if our system is based on supply and demand, what demand is there for the military? I mean, does that mean we have to shoot off these missiles and drop the bombs in order to create more?
My understanding of that is that the government has created a demand for it supposedly because we want security. I don't know who they're talking to.
Yeah, but
exactly.
How much can you stop?
But here's what they're really doing.
How many aircraft carriers can we buy?
Recommended, yeah.
Yeah, but you see, as they produce more and more of it, and much of it sits, some of it's out in the ocean or whatever, moving about. What they're really doing is taking away from your ability to consume goods. Because they're taking your income in the form of taxes, and unless you have a lot to say about how the government spends money, you will let the government officials decide how it will be spent, say in the military, and it leaves you with, you take your income and you subtract taxes, and then what you might save, that leaves you with your consumption. And so what they're doing is making decisions for you on how you're going to spend your money. And when you realize does the average family spend in the area of $2,000 for military, that's $2,000 that might have been spent on goods elsewhere in the economy. So what they're doing is just taking away the option of you. I mean, you are buying missiles and whatever, and much of it's sitting there, and that's your money that's buying it. And what you're getting in return for it is, some may be getting the satisfaction of protection. Some may see it as just a complete waste. And so, but still, I don't think it interrupts the economy to the extent that, it just has the devastating effect. It just means that you put your money in some military things. Whether you like it or not, that's what we decided, and you're part of the system, and so you do that. You give your tax money, they build military goods, and what you get for it isn't what you get when you spend $2,000 on food or something. But if it undermines the economy, I think it's what Larry mentioned too, that sector gets bigger, it leaves less for the private sector to do things,
perhaps,
to save and invest, and become more productive.
Why the economist doesn't deal with the military-industrial complex is so inefficient. It doesn't seem to actually be bringing back to the economy that which we anticipate that it should.
Yeah.
again, because I haven't done much at all in this area, it's difficult to discuss. But
well, it's only 5% of the GNP or something, isn't it? Or whatever, 25% of 25% or so. It's just down the rat hole. Okay, there it is. It's protect the country. It's not.
Yeah. I guess my feeling is that the consensus in the United States, well, not consensus, but I mean the maybe the majority feels that that 5% sacrifice is worth the security.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that there aren't a lot of people who are complaining about it.
Yeah, that's right. The vote in the Senate was 99-1.
Who the Senate?
Mark has been more.
Can I ask something about the survey about the having the satisfaction of the job and the growth of Japan's and Germany's economy? That maybe our growth has also to do, and their growth, with the quality of goods, maybe that, because if they're...
You're saying that if you measure the growth in just dollar terms, you don't see the change in quality.
Yeah.
And that maybe we, even though our growth isn't so great, or theirs is, you have to look at the quality of the goods?
Yeah, maybe their quality is better, and that's... And it never used to, and because our growth years past, because maybe the quality was better?
Well, certainly their quality has improved. I remember when made in Japan was something to be laughed at. Mm-hmm. You turn it over and you see it made in Japan.
Now
when you say it's made in Japan, yeah, you see, oh, it's made in the U.S., yeah. But I think the reasons are a little bit different. First of all, Japan and Germany fear inflation like we fear depression. Their history is that they've had hyperinflation, wild inflation in a couple of periods. And so they will do anything, almost anything, to prevent inflation. We don't have that attitude here. We're afraid of unemployment, and as the unemployment grows, we're willing to put more money in and get more inflation. Now we're thinking differently about it, but we were for a while. And when inflation's low, you get much more productivity, you get much more investment, much more encouragement to save. I'll talk about that quite extensively on the inflation part, but that's one of the things. Second, they haven't had the extensive involvement on the part of the government in their economies, at least in the military area, some of those. But I guess the other one that I, here's what I really admire about Japan. They cooperate more than they compete with each other. And when I look at how the Japanese have solved their environmental problems and how they do a lot of their work, and I'll include Sweden in on this too, and to some extent Norway, what the people do is the workers have their representatives, management has their representatives, and government has their representatives, and they get together and solve the problems. And so they say, now, what's the best way to solve it? There are many costs, but let's find a fair and equitable way to handle this. And they hash it out, negotiate, and they come up with a solution. In the United States, the government's saying one thing, the workers are saying another thing, management's saying another thing, and we just fight each other, and it's a hard time to find any kind of a solution. I think that in Japan, when you join the firm, you become pretty much a lifetime member of the firm, and the way they work together is very different, and that says a lot about productivity.
That sort of thing. An illustration of what you were just saying, you may recall back in the early 60s, there was one bad year of that in cars, and I had to recall a lot of them, and the dealers had lots of trouble with them. And the solution was that the Diet of Japan called the officials of the Datsun company on the carpet and said, look, we just can't have this happen again. Go back and straighten out your act. And there's a certain amount of government control. It may be evidenced in a different way than ours is.
That's where I should be careful about that, because the Japanese have an amazing mixture between government and private sector. The government comes in and helps out when it needs to help out, and then it gets out. And it has the ability of not wanting to hang on to something that they've set up. They know when to retreat. So they make loans available to their firms at fairly low interest rates. Of course, they've been able to keep the inflation down. That helps a lot of interest rates. And they at the very beginning, they nationalized. This is decades ago. They nationalized certain industries to get them started, and they withdrew and let the private sector take over. So it's just so interesting the way they seem to work together rather than always trying to get a certain piece of the action for themselves and worrying about what somebody else is giving us. Much more cooperation. Yes.
I was just going to make a point, and I think it's in Schumacher's book about Buddhist economics.
Yeah.
So much of this depends on our cultural heritage. And I was thinking of Japan and their, of course, relation with Buddhism and some Confucianism. And I was thinking then of the United States and our religious cultural heritage and what it says, what our present predicament might obviously points to, I think, in especially in relation to Christianity and to the essence of Christianity, which I think almost every theologian would say is compassion and love, and yet somehow down the line that's gotten transformed into personal security first, and the notion of compassion has become perverted, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in a fairly subtle and unconscious fashion, to the degree that it's part of our mindset. And it isn't that we're just dealing with it with different economic systems, we're dealing with,
yeah,
with mm-hmm. the entire human consciousness.
There's an interesting note on that almost classic essay now by Schumacher on Buddhist economics. Schumacher said one time, he'd just as soon have called it Christian economics, because the emphasis is on restraint of material desires and limiting wants and being most efficient with a sense of the finitude of the earth's resources. Mm-hmm. That's Christian economics, but if I called it Christian economics, no one would have recognized it. I call it Buddhist economics.
But when I look at that different definition of economics, there's any doubt that I read Schumacher late 60s, before his books came out, and I went and did my graduate work in appropriate technologies, still before his books came out, because he was such a fascinating person. And I guess, I hope I shouldn't have taken any kind of credit for putting that on the board. If I didn't say Schumacher, certainly that's, you get all these ideas, they feed into you, and you don't remember where they all come from, but that's right, in that chapter he said, there are three reasons to work, too. One is to build some community and cooperation and work together, another is to the satisfaction of that you get from working, and he says what we do in the United States is we want to try and get rid of work. We don't want to work. I mean, if you say to somebody, how hard do you work? You say, well, I only work about 5% of the time, and that's really good. Instead of saying, no, I work hard and I love it. But that's a great chapter.
You might mention the book.
Yes, I'm going to mention two books here. Small is Beautiful is a Schumacher book. It came out about 72, I think, or 73. Very readable. And the subtitle is just excellent. It says, Economics as if People Matter. I taught an interim once on Economics as if People Matter, and People and Nature Matter. You couldn't believe all the students that wanted to sign up for it because it just seemed so different. And nobody even knew who I was. It was just the title is catchy, and it's a very humane look at economics. It's a collection of his articles, so you can skip around from different parts. And he died about a year or two ago, sudden heart attack. But he was an incredible individual. And when I was in London, we went over to visit his organization, and had a chance to hear him speak. And for any economist who cares about people, or anybody who cares about people and might know something about economics, it's really a good book. In fact, Matthew Fox, which is one of the theme texts here, in the beginning, I think he has a dedication, and so he mentions that it's in the memory of Schumacher and somebody else, and he's quoted often in here. And I don't know if the person is here that was here yesterday to talk about the new international economic order. But this week was domestic issues, but next week I want to deal with international issues. And there's a book that came out, Bread and Justice. It's called Toward a New International Economic Order by James McGinnis. He comes out of the Catholic faith and works out of St. Louis. It's an Institute for Peace and Justice. This book, we've used this book on Luther campus. It's been used at Augustana in Sioux Falls. It's been used at the Wartburg College and very well received.
It's easy reading. That's what's so nice. You don't have to be an authority in economics. And I think the best thing about it is it doesn't just talk about some of the problems. It talks about action. Most of the times you talk about the problems and then it's time to leave. Or it isn't time to leave. You just make sure it's time to leave. And here it says, what are some things that we can do? It's a very good book, Ken.
What's the name of it?
It's Bread and Justice. It's by James McGinnis. In fact, we called our course, it's an interdisciplinary course, Bread, representing some economics, Justice, the theologian, the philosopher, the moral part of it, and then we added Peace to it to get the political scientists in there. So we call our course Peace, Bread, and Justice. But you don't often try and sell books unless you feel pretty good about them. Bread and Justice has really been, I think, a very successful book. And there's also a teacher's manual which goes with it, which I think might even be better than the book. And usually a teacher's manual, it's the same size. It's just a little pamphlet that comes out. But Schumacher, it's an excellent book on Bread and Justice.